You're listening to America's Web Radio on the AmericasBroadcastNetwork.com. Thank you for listening.
And welcome to America's Web Radio. We've got a very special guest today. We've got Colonel, retired, Leon Lee Ellis with us today, and you can see him on the air right now. Now, we'll see how good you are, Colonel. I don't want a brigadier to outdo you, but Richard Dix, Dix was in the other day, and I hit him with this, and he joined right in. So I don't know about colonels and generals, because I was a grunt, but we'll see how well you do with this.
Hey, I feel all right now.
Well, it's good to be here.
Hey, I feel all right now.
Do you feel like I do right now?
Do you feel like I do right now?
Motivated.
Motivated.
Sounds like boot camp. Well, you know, even in AIT, we still did it. I don't know anything about the Air Force, to be quite honest, other than I have a son that's a major in the Air Force serving in Germany now.
Well, good.
And, he's an intel officer, and I don't, you know, his statement to me keeps being, well, Dad, if I told you, I'd have to kill you. But,
yeah.
You know, and so I leave the questions on the table and don't really ask.
Understand.
But so I don't know. Surely when you all are marching, I realize not officers in a, well, I guess you don't even call them platoons, do you?
No, we don't call them, we call them flights.
Flights, yeah.
Flights, okay. Squadrons, wings.
Okay, well, anyway, do the flights, when they're marching, do they use Jodys?
Yes, they do.
Okay.
They did when I was there.
Well,
I wasn't the best to call them. I always found someone more talented than me and delegated that whenever I could.
Well, I tell you what, I and it's been since 19. Well, I got out in 75, but I did my basic in AIT in 70, and it's taken me this long to really, and the fun of talking to General Dix and Rick White and many of them, and certainly Mike Mazzell and Johns Creek. But it's taken me this long to really realize and appreciate the psychology in the military. And it's like, you know, I can remember back, I did my active at Fort Ord, and, you know, and I was infantry, and so we would go on these horrendous marches and double time. And, you know, your legs would feel like they're about to fall off, and then somebody would start up a Jody.
Mm-hmm.
And you just, psychologically, you felt better, and you're going to make it that next mile or whatever it happened
mm-hmm.
to be. But everything's, and it's, I guess it's all come together over since the Revolution or whatever, and it's amazing what, you know, I guess one of the biggest things in the Army side of it and Marine side of it is, you know, they beat it into you, not literally, but figuratively, when that sergeant or commanding officer says hit it, you hit the ground,
mm-hmm.
and you don't pop your head up to say why. You
right.
just do it.
Well, it's all about teamwork, and, you know, going back to the Jody says, I'm not alone. You know, I may be starting to feel sorry for myself. My legs are starting to hurt. I'm wondering how long is this going to go on? Is it ever going to get over? But when the Jody starts, all of a sudden we have these voices coming together, and you realize that the team is together. We're marching along together. We're pulling along together. And the human being was created to be in community. Now, we all operate individually, but we're also created to be community individuals, and when we have a community around us, we're much stronger. The research shows that old people who live alone die much quicker. They're
Uh-oh, I'm in trouble.
They're Medicare, well, when I mean isolated, you know, when their Medicare bills go up, and they die sooner when they're living isolated. And so being in a community is just very important.
you know, so right and so well said. And I've said this, and certainly not the first, but so many great veterans have come in here, and I always want to salute Colonel White, Rick White. He has sent us the best of the best from the, and this is the Georgia Military Veterans Hall of Fame Hour, mm-hmm. and we dedicate it to the Hall of Fame and to all of the people that are have been inducted into it, like yourself, and it's our little small way of reaching out to hundreds of thousands of folks to say thank you, and we do. But one of the points that I was going to make is that over the years, well, again, it's a thing of psychology, but the fact of the matter is the military, and it doesn't matter which branch, from Coast Guard, which is overlooked many times, but from the Coast Guard to the grunt, it's the biggest fraternity and sorority in the world. And I'm proud of my younger son that's in the Air Force, stationed in Germany, and he's doing a heck of a job. And, you know, it's just, I don't know, you have a feel when someone like yourself walks in, and, you know, I was about as low as you can get, and you were climbing the ladder, but we still have the mutual respect and the fact that, you know, we served.
Yes, I couldn't agree more. I was in Montana this past weekend on Saturday, speaking that morning to the Montana Air National Guard, the 120th Airlift Wing up in Great Falls, and then that afternoon went down to Helena and spoke to the Army National Guard, well, both together, the tag there they call it, but it was both. And I said to them that night evening, I said, you know, I haven't met you all until tonight, but I feel a close bond because we all wear the uniform. And you used a great word there, saying we're part of a fraternity, and I think we all feel that way.
You know, again, I was in the Vietnam era, and I always point out on the show that I did not serve in Vietnam. I was in the era, and I was an AR and NG, and did my six and was out. Mm-hmm. But you know, and I feel very, very humbled that people like General Dix and so forth would say, no, you're as much of a
absolutely
veteran as I am.
You are.
And I never felt like that, but in doing the show, and I want to remind everybody that on March the 28th, and I don't believe that date is, I haven't been notified, but March the 28th, the Johns Creek Healing Wall will be presented. They'll have the ribbon cutting ceremony and so forth, and it's a 50% replica that traveled all over the United States, and of the Vietnam Wall in Washington. And it has found its permanent home in Johns Creek, Georgia. And we invite everybody that knew somebody or whatever, or loved one or whatever, to come out to Johns Creek on March the 28th and be a part of the ceremony. It's going to be great.
Sounds good.
And so let's talk about, do you prefer Sir, Leon, Lee, or should I just be standing with in parade rest?
Just Lee.
Just Lee.
Just Lee.
Okay. You flew a Phantom.
Yes.
How would you describe that plane? Okay, is it the...
I describe it in my book and when I speak sometimes as a beautiful, ugly beast. It was beautiful in that it was sleek. It was a beast, and it was very muscular, and it was ugly in that it had a degree of fierceness to it, as it was a fighter-bomber. It was built for the Navy originally as an interceptor, but the Air Force used it as more of a fighter-bomber in both air-to-air and air-to-ground, and I was mostly involved in air-to-ground. So it's a twin-engine fighter airplane, fairly large compared to World War II airplanes, but a little bit larger, a little bit heavier.
Okay, the tail is different on the...
Yes, it was the first that had this. It had a scalloped tail at the back end there, and so it was very clearly, you know, clear to identify that. And then it also, the slab on the back end wasn't fixed. It, the whole slab, instead of having little tabs on the elevators, the whole, it was called, it was, had a different name for it. I've forgotten what it knows. It wasn't that, but the whole elevator rotated and tilted. So to go up and down, you pull the stick back and the elevator back end of it goes down, and you climb up and you push forward and the elevator goes down. In that case, this whole thing rotated. So it was a little bit unusual, some modern things into it. It had leading edge flaps. It had BLC, boundary layer control, with compressed air coming off the engine, blowing over the wings to keep the to help it stay stable in the air in the stall arena. So it would actually fly fairly slow without stalling for a jet that big and heavy. So it was a pretty advanced airplane for its day.
Interesting. And a stick. That's interesting, too.
Yes. Oh, yeah, stick. We all of
instead
our
of it, no yoke,
stick.
Huh?
No, no yokes. The yokes were more for the bigger, larger cargo airplanes and bombers. The fighters always had sticks. In World War II, the P-38 did have kind of a yoke stick. It had a stick, but had a little yoke up on the top of it there, too. So, but generally, the stick, because you can fly with one hand, and you've got the one hand on the throttles and one hand on the stick, and on the stick, you have all sorts of buttons and switches on the stick. The pickle button, you know, to pickle the bombs, but switches you can turn off and on with your left hand on the throttle and your right hand on the stick. It's really helpful also when you're pulling G's to have that stick that comes up out of the floor. The current fighters have, the F-16 was the first one that had electronic system, so it actually didn't, it wasn't a manual when you pull on the stick.
By the wire?
Fly by the wire, that's right. It was electronic, so it would be like on a joystick you'd see on a game, video game today. And people, the pilots had to kind of learn to fly that because it was, it didn't have the sense of heaviness and feel when you're pulling G's and turning and all. So they finally put in a little bit of a system to give it a little bit of stiffness to it so you could feel like you were pulling G's when you were.
Where'd you do your flight training?
I went through Valdosta, Georgia at Moody Air Force Base. You know, I'd always wanted to fly from the time I was 5 years old. I went down, my parents took me down, my family went down to the park in Athens, Georgia, Memorial Park. And there was an old World War II fighter there on the pedestal. I climbed up on that thing, and it's like, okay, this is me. And from 5 years old then on, I wanted to be a pilot. 3 days after I graduated from the University of Georgia, actually 3 days from, I hadn't even graduated. I finished my last class. They commissioned me, and I went straight to Valdosta and got in flight school.
Wow. What was in the, what was, well, let me preface this by saying that, that Colonel Ellis was unfortunately shot down and served one of the long, you were a guest of, for longer than most at the Hanoi Hilton, but I want to back up before that and get a little bit of the history. And hold up your book. So let's uh-huh. let's put a plug in. Leading with Honor, okay. And you were a guest of the Hanoi Hilton after being shot down. But what was in your mind as you were going through flight school? I know many. I've known many pilots, and they felt like their bird was part of them. They literally were an extension of the bird, or mm-hmm. or the bird was an extension yeah. of them, whichever mm-hmm. way you want to say it. But did you ever imagine anything other than coming out of every flight?
No, I think you have to think positive. You have to believe that you're going to do the mission and come back, and you operate that way until things get beyond your control and you can operate that way, and then you have to make a decision. When I was going through combat training out in California and to get qualified in the F-4, when I got my wings, my first orders as an operational pilot in the Air Force were F-4 Phantom Pipeline Southeast Asia, which meant as soon as they could get us combat qualified, we'd be going to war. But we had lost a couple of airplanes out there in training, And so the wing commander had an all-pilots meeting at the officers' club one day after lunch and just chewed us out for staying in the airplane too long and not making that decision to eject. And for whatever reason, a person might stay in because pilots were tending to stay in too long trying to save the airplane. And he said, you have to know when to step out. And I thought that was really great advice.
You know, it's like you're flying $1 million, $2 million, $10 million, whatever it is, cost of the airplane, but that ain't nothing compared to what the military has invested in you.
Exactly, and he made that point. You know, we spend a lot of money training you to fly this airplane, and there comes a time when you need to get out, and you need to forget your pride and forget how great a pilot you are. At that point, you need to know that it's not going to fly, and you're going to hit the ground soon and get out. So I thought, well, that's good advice, especially going into combat. And sure enough, when that decision time came, I made it in a split second, because the airplane was actually blown into pieces, and I knew it wasn't going to fly anywhere. And even though I was over enemy territory, over the gunners and the militia that were shooting at us, I was going to parachute right into the hornet's nest, so to speak. But even still, I was doing everything I could to evade as we came down.
Evade, escaping, and evade, and... Yeah, been there, done that, sort of. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to be back with Colonel Ellis right after a couple of messages. Stay with us.
Good morning. My name is Mike Mizell. I'm a retired Army colonel and president of the Johns Creek Veterans Association. We meet in Newtown Park, and part of one of our projects is the installation of the Healing Wall, the half-scale model of the Vietnam Wall that traveled the United States. Well, it's coming to rest, and it's going to live in Johns Creek forever, the half-scale model. We're looking at possibly a March implementation ribbon-cutting ceremony, and we're looking for donors and sponsors that want to help us in this great project. You can donate at jcvets.org.
Whether cruising the strip in a 57 Chevy or taking the family on a vacation in a 71 Oldsmobile Vista Cruiser, you need to tune in to Classic Cars with Steve Rinaldo and Jim Weber every Saturday from 8 to 9 a.m. on americaswebradio.com.
Happy holidays. I'm Patty Levan, owner of Multiline Mortgage Services, Inc. Call us for details about our conventional loans with as little as 3% down, or talk to us about our FHA, VA, and USDA loan options. We answer your questions with honesty and integrity, because that's how we roll. Multiline Mortgage Services, your way home. Call us at 941-201-9111 or check out our website at multilinemortgage.com. Company founded by Joseph D. Powers, NMLS 158989, licensed Georgia and Florida.
This is America's Web Radio. Would you like to have a show, talk about your business, or express your opinion on America's Web Radio? Just email gm@americaswebradio.com and we'll get back to you. Thank you.
And we're back. You're listening to America's Web Radio, and this is the Georgia Military Veterans Hall of Fame Hour, and the Hall of Fame is downtown, and we had a young lady on that said, "Oh, I walk through there every day." And she works downtown and parks next to it or something, and it's in the Floyd Building, it is just. It's a very inspiring and very humbling situation to go through it. And we want you to get off your can. Unfortunately, and Rick and I have talked about this. I don't know what will ever happen with this, but it's unfortunate that it's not open on the weekends. It's only open Monday through Friday. And but if you've got people visiting from any place, take them to the Georgia Military Veterans Hall of Fame, and it will be worth every second that you're in there. And I've had people that weren't even military in and have been through it, and when they start talking about it, they choke up. Mm-hmm. And it's that inspiring. So you were an inductee in...
About 5 years ago.
The class of... 2014,
15, somewhere in there.
Okay.
My life is going by so quickly these days, the years.
Well, know. I think that's mine too. Is the older you get, the faster they go, and you say, yeah. "Whoa, Nelly, let's slow these suckers down a little bit." So, we were talking about the F-4 Phantom, and that's what you were flying when? How would you compare, and I don't know if this is a fair question or unfair question, keeping up, I'm amazed at the stealth bomber that we have today. Mm-hmm. Do you think that would have made a difference in your life?
Probably not, because the mission that I was on was a particular mission that it wasn't so well suited for stealth. There was a lots of areas that would have been suited for stealth, but the particular mission I was on was interdiction and also the bombing of the gun sites that were protecting the ferries and the bridges and that sort of thing. And I guess some of that they could have done, but ours had to be a little bit more real time.
Mm-hmm. Would that have been considered? That wouldn't have been considered close air, though. Close air support is when you're going in close.
No,
to
but
the
I did do close air support in the South with the Army and the Marine Corps, so we did that. But this was kind of in between close air support and just true bombing that you would think about more of the stealth, taking out key targets like that. We did some of that in Vietnam.
NRF-52. That's it.
Yeah.
40,000 feet or whatever.
Yeah, but the 105s and the F-4s. The F-4s did a lot of that, too, up around Hanoi, the steel mills and those sort of things, yeah.
I don't generally get political, but you're sort of in a situation that you were there, you've been there, done that, and I've often wondered, you know, we brought them to their knees basically when we sent the 52s in and started the carpet bombing.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think we should have started that many years before?
Well, if we were going to be there, we probably should have. I mean, why should we go on fighting years and years, nipping at the edges? You could argue both sides, okay? But the one thing we do know is that people who use power don't respect weakness. They respect power. And there was not a lot of heat coming to the people in Hanoi who were running the show. And so if you're going to go out and kill people and do all that, why not go to the center of it and take that out?
Hello? Didn't that happen a couple of days
ago? Why not go take the center out? Usually that gets to the bottom line a lot quicker.
You know, I love my country, and I love our flag, and I love the military, and proud to have served. But the one place that we seem to have always had a problem is our foreign affairs and knowledge of a country that, you know, I had friends come back from Nam that said, "Oh my God, you know, there was jungle over there. What do we do?" You know, and then we hadn't been trained, and all of a sudden Fort Polk and Fort Ord became training centers mm-hmm. where they had green.
Mm-hmm.
And then here we go to Desert Shield and Desert Storm, and we're using or trying to use some of our experience from Vietnam, and yet they ain't got no green over there. It's all
right.
Dirt.
Right.
And, you know, so we, there's a, in my opinion, and hopefully it's changing, but there's a lapse. I mean, none of us want to go to war. That's the first thing. But if we're going, we should know it better. And I think one of the most humbling things and one of the best things that President Trump has done was sign the Blue Water Bill on December 10th. And for the folks that don't know what that is, we've talked about it before. It was a bill that gave benefits to the Navy and also the Coast Guard that served in country in Vietnam, but they weren't getting off their boats. And so the ultimate wisdom of Congress had said, well, they didn't get off their boats. They shouldn't get benefits for Agent Orange. Well, I don't have a whole lot of respect for Congress if they haven't served, but our Marines, our Navy, and our Coast Guard were getting sprayed, or they get the backwash of Agent Orange, and they're showing up now and will for years with the effects of Agent Orange, but now they're getting benefits.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it's you know, the first part of what you were talking about, the desert and the jungles, and we weren't quite as well thought through on that. You know, one of the things that the Air Force and the Navy did during the war was we realized that those first 10 missions that fighter pilots were flying, we had the highest losses. And so we put in a program, the Air Force did and the Navy did. The Navy's became famous because of Top Gun. Yeah. In the Air Force, we had a program also called Red Flag, and it did the same thing. Was to give the fighter pilots some combat experience, and also they brought in the whole war fighting mentality of the people who did the control and the on the ground air controllers and so on. They brought them all in to give them that combat experience out in the. It was out in the desert because we have a lot of uncontrolled airspace, or the government owns a lot of land there that we can use for. Target work and all that sort of thing, but they gave them some experience to show them what it was like, and they even had communist fighter jets out there to fly against. And we had some that were our jets, but they were painted up and flew the tactics of the enemy so that our guys could get practice to kind of give them the experience of those first 10 missions, so when they got there, they'd feel a little bit more comfortable about what war was really like.
What percentage, I know that, or correct me if I'm wrong, and I could be very wrong, but it was my understanding for a while that there were Russian pilots flying for Vietnamese, and how would you rate their training and the training of the Vietnamese pilots?
Well, we've always suspected there were Russian pilots there. I knew I was in Moscow in 1996. Actually, I was up in St. Petersburg, and friends of mine that were hosting us there. Well, there were friends of mine that took me there had a friend in St. Petersburg hosting us, and their next door neighbor was a good friend, and he had been a Russian pilot, a Russian MiG pilot, fighter pilot, and so. He was kind of mumbling along at dinner there, and then they told him that I was a fighter pilot in Vietnam, and he about dropped his fork. But then he wanted to ask all sorts of questions. But he had been to Vietnam. He claimed he didn't fly any missions there, but he had been to Vietnam. So we suspect that they did train them. We know they trained them, and some of them trained in Russia and some in China. We don't know how many missions they flew, but most of the missions were actually flown by the Vietnamese pilots, and especially as the war went on. But they had a presence there.
We're going to have to break in here and take another break. We're on the Georgia Military Veterans Hall of Fame Hour, and we have Colonel Lee Ellison with us today. And Lee, thank you so much for coming in. And this show, you know, has just grown and grown with the help of Rick White, Colonel White, at the Georgia Military Veterans Hall of Fame. And we'll be back right after this.
Good morning. My name is Mike Mizell. I'm a retired Army colonel and president of the Johns Creek Veterans Association. We meet in Newtown Park, and part of one of our projects is the installation of the Healing Wall, the half-scale model of the Vietnam Wall that traveled the United States. Well, it's coming to rest, and it's going to live in Johns Creek forever, the half-scale model. We're looking at possibly a march implementation ribbon cutting ceremony, and we're looking for donors and sponsors that want to help us in this great project. You can donate at jcvets.org.
This is Ron Camacho, host of the Business Hour, on Fridays from 10 to 11 a.m. Join me as I talk with passionate professionals on a program that profiles the best businesses, business professionals, business practices, and fascinating individuals to get an insider view of how America works, 10 to 11 a.m. on America's Web Radio.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper. Write down www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. That's www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. Go to our site and please make a generous tax-deductible donation and join the fight today. Thank you.
My name is Kyle Hayes, a motorsports student at Alfred State College. Every year, Alfred State students compete in the Great Race, which is a cross-country time endurance rally for vintage vehicles. As you can imagine, it's pretty costly. I'm asking for your help. Your donation can make it possible for these students to live their passion and promote the vintage automobile industry. Please visit our site at give.alfredstate.edu and search Great Race to learn more and help us reach our goal. Thank you.
Quick Stakes, that's Q-U-I-K Stakes, are not just for surveyors. They are great for family and community gardens. Go online to www.quickstake.com or contact your local land surveying supply dealer and get you a box of Quick Stakes. You'll love them every year when you plant your garden. Again, that's Quick Stakes, Q-U-I-K Stakes, the truly preferred way to stake and identify what's in your garden now.
You're listening to America's Web Radio on the AmericasBroadcastNetwork.com. Thank you for listening.
Okay, we're back with Colonel Lee Ellis, and we're talking about Vietnam, and I would be negligent, and we should have talked about this before, but does your experience with the Hilton bother you in any way? Or we had Roger Wise on.
Uh-huh.
And he outdid you by a year and 4 months, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
You were in the Hilton for 5 years, and he was in 6 years and 4 months. And I can't imagine anything that like that in that experience.
Well, we were well trained and well led, and most of the guys, the average person captured, were mostly air crew there in the north. They didn't bring up too many Army guys they captured. There were probably maybe 100 or more total, and most of those came in the Tet Offensive of 68. And they were generally in a different camp, so we didn't see too much of them. But the average POW was 30 and a half when they were captured, and I had just turned 24. So I'm one of the young guys. But still, if you think about an 18, 19-year-old kid going in the military and going to war, we were a lot older and more mature. Well, that gives you more resilience. The older you are, generally, the more you've seen of life and the more resilient you are. And we had leaders that were born in the 1923, 24, 25 time frame. And they came in at the end of World War II and gone through the Depression. So we had very good leadership We had a strong team, even though we had to communicate covertly.
Yeah, how long did it take you to learn the tap?
The tap code is a 5x5 matrix. There's 26 letters in the alphabet, and we left out K and used C for K. So you go down and then across every letter. So to say hi, you go down 2 and over 3, there's the H. You go down 2 and over 4, there's the I, and you had to... That was high. But, you know, in the prison camp, when you're all locked up and you're sitting there, you don't have much to do a lot of the time. And so you just sit there, and I would sit and tap on my knee until I got faster and faster and faster with it, more comfortable with it. And I became the lead communicator myself because I was kind of young and antsy and wanted something to do, and I guess I'm a communicator. I'm a really good cautious risk taker. I'm a good risk taker, but I know when to push and when to hold back pretty well.
I think Kenny Rogers came out with a song, Know When to Hold 'Em and Know When to Fold 'Em.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And so that was kind of that served me well in the POW camp there. But, you know, the resilience, we learned that we had so much more resilience, mental, emotional resilience, and physical resilience. I mean, we had guys there with all sorts of problems, guys that were shot and didn't get much care, and but somehow they made it 5, 6, 7, 8 years. I had a couple of cellmates that were there 8 years. Can you imagine? I was only there 5 and a half, so I was a young guy and a new guy. I'm one of the new boys because they stopped the bombing, and for a long time there were no new people coming in till the very end of the war. So if you only had five years or you know, you were a new guy, and if you had 8, you were an old guy. So there was a good spread in there. But the resilience, I think the leadership, the training that we had had was really, really good to prepare us for that. Nobody expected to be a POW, but we had a duty. We, you know, we wore the uniform. We had a job to do, and it just changed. When we got captured, our duty was to resist the enemy, and our motto and our mission, vision, and values was resist, survive, and return with honor. Well, that's a pretty big challenge in that situation. But we were committed to do it, and we had leadership that set an example. We had leadership that was humble and confident. They were humble in that they weren't perfect, and when they couldn't come through the way they wanted to, they told us. And nobody could do, they could torture you and make you do something, and they wouldn't let you die. They were expert torturers. So there would come a time when you're going to have to do something, but you wanted to fall back to your second round of defense and give them something, but not anything of value. And that was a challenge.
How did you feel about Fonda?
Well, I didn't know who Jane Fonda was, of course, until I heard her on Hanoi Hannah, the Hanoi propaganda radio that was broadcast to the troops in the field. Now, I'm sitting in the POW camp, but every cell had a speaker in it. And 3 times a day, we got propaganda. Every cell in North Vietnam that had electricity in the camp had a speaker. 3 times a day, we got fed propaganda telling us why they're right and we're wrong. And so Hanoi Hannah would always be talking about those who died not for the fatherland, and they would use propaganda, you know, anti-war stuff from the U.S. And of course, they tried to convince us they were right and we should help them end the war by making anti-war statements and the bombing should stop kind of statements. And we resisted that. So that was our daily battle, really, was to resist their propaganda efforts. But here's what happened with Jane Fonda. She came over in 72 and recorded messages to the troops that they played on Hanoi Hannah on their radio station that broadcast to the troops in the South. But they also played it for us in the camp, and Jane Fonda did make a tape for the POWs, for the mainly pilots who were shot down and captured and held there in Hanoi. And her message was, basically, you should help end this war. It's immoral, unjust, and wrong, and all this. And you should help end this war by making anti-war statements, and to the troops on the ground, she said, you should lay down your arms. So she certainly aided and abetted the enemy of her own free will, which is the definition of treason. Beyond that, there are, I will say this, there are a lot of things on the internet about Jane Fonda that are not true, that she hurt the POWs by passing a note and squealing on them and all like that, and that is not true. She never saw a POW face-to-face. So that is not true. She didn't do that. But she did collaborate with the enemy and aid and abet them. So, but, you know, we came home and did on our way home, well, eventually the torture stopped thanks to the American people and the pressure they put on the communists. And so during that time after the torture stopped, we knew we had to get our head on straight. We were a mess. We were angry. We were bitter. We were just psychologically a mess. We would have had really bad PTSD if we'd come home in 1969. But locked up with people who'd been through worse than we had for 2 years, we were locked up like that. We had time to say, okay, we got to get ready to come home. We're a mess. And we did. We got ready to come home and be healthy emotionally and mentally. And so in a way, staying there in those years, those last years, was a curse, but it was also a blessing in that we came home. Our group has really done well. We've been very successful. Former POWs have. I think we learned to focus. We learned to forgive and move on. We knew that if we came home bitter, they would have us in shackles.
Did you, in what I was sent, it stated that part of what got you through was your faith.
Yes, very strong. I grew up in a strong Christian home. I knew the Bible fairly well, prayed a lot. And when they didn't kill me, right after capture, they captured me within a couple of minutes after I got on the ground. Had great training, but I was surrounded and captured. And when they didn't kill me right away, I just believed that God had a purpose for me, and my job was to hang on. I didn't know how it was going to work out, didn't know how long it was going to be there. My job is just to do my job and let that work itself out and believe that someday it will. And I didn't give up hope. I didn't give up faith. But in the POW camps, I think most every one of us realized that there's somebody bigger than us in charge. And, of course, I knew that very well and was able to share stories and my faith in the camp with my cellmates. And that was very important to all of us.
We're going to have to take another break, and we'll be back with Colonel Lee Ellis right after this.
Perhaps you are struggling to cope with the disease of addiction. If not, you probably know a family member or friend that needs help in battling the cravings and the personal and professional damage done by the effects of drugs or alcohol. Get a pen and paper and be ready to write down the following. These are the issues that the trained staff at the Atlanta Healing Center address and treat every day. Their doctors and counselors with over 40 years of practice in the field of addiction can treat the suffering individual in a thoughtful, compassionate, and experienced manner and guide him or her along the path to recovery. So call 770-696-9862 and speak to a knowledgeable staff member about how you or your loved one can be helped to enjoy a better and healthier life. More information is also available on the website at www.atlantahealingcenter.com.
Season's greetings. I'm Patty LeVan, owner of Multiline Mortgage Services, Inc. Let's talk about reverse mortgages for seniors 62 and older. Reverse mortgages were designed to free up money that seniors can use at their discretion in retirement. Let us help you determine if this program is right for you. We'll help you choose the right lender and walk you through the loan process. Multiline Mortgage Services, your way home. Call us at 941-201-9111 or check out our website at multilinemortgage.com. Company founded by Joseph D. Powers, NMLS 158989, licensed in Georgia and Florida.
You're listening to America's Web Radio on the AmericasBroadcastNetwork.com. Thank you for listening.
And we're back on America's Web Radio and the David's Pick Show, but it's also the Georgia Military Veterans Hall of Fame Hour. And we encourage each and every one of you to, if you haven't been, go. And if you've got guests coming into the city, go. And then they're going to be having a presentation,
End of the month.
End of the month, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't have the date off the top of my head for some. So, Lee, do you all do the ones that you serve time with in the Hanoi Hilton, do you all keep in touch fairly?
Yes, we do. Closely. We have reunions. We used to have them 5 years apart. Then we went to three, and then we said we're getting old and dying off, maybe two. And so we're having two. And then with the other, with the Fighter Pilots Organization and the Air Commandos and Sante Raiders who raided the camp, those groups, we ended up having one. Now there's something almost every year that we can go to, you know, with the Fighter Pilot Reunion, the River Rats.
Okay.
And we also have a listserv and a newsletter. One guy that puts together, like, we have a lot of people dying, and he said, okay, we got three funerals in Arlington this month, and here are the dates and that sort of thing. So, we stay together.
Do any of you do, like, an honor guard for that, or?
Well, we will go.
Or do you use one that Arlington supplies?
Oh, no, they supply their own, yeah.
Okay.
The states or the local organizations, military organizations, will provide an honor guard. Yeah.
You know, I have this thing, and I want to get into your thoughts, and I ask if it's okay to ask, and I will in just a second, but I have a, I don't know, it drives me sort of nuts, is that we have people listening today, we have people that have listened yesterday and will listen to the archives. And the one thing that I always come back to is that I'm having a hard and harder time accepting Congress and people that we elect or we hire in reality to do a job for us that have never served, never been there, never done that, and certainly. And I serve, but I can't even come close. I can't say I can imagine what it'd be. No, I can't imagine at all what it would, the trauma that you went through and how you survived it, or any of them, and particularly those that, you know, my God, hung by your thumbs for days on end or whatever. I just, you know, I can't.
Well, I think, as I said earlier, doing your duty and recognizing that others are doing their best, so you do the best you can. And, you know, one of the things we learned is that people are all different. Now, on a bell curve, military-trained people are generally going to be a little bit more courageous probably than the guy in the street, only because they've been more trained for specific situations and how to handle them. But so we would be more skewed toward being the courageous, committed-to-duty kind of mentality. But even so, in that, we had a wide array of ability to resist the enemy, ability to take torture. I mean, some guys could go 3 days with a certain kind of torture, and some two, and some one, and some a few hours.
I'd,
and that's just human differences.
Me, what do you want to know?
So, you know, just knowing that other guys were doing their best, too, and we're a competitive bunch. You know, I asked one guy who was there 8 years. I said, Smitty, when you were out at the Briar Branch camp and they were torturing everybody and going through, and I know you're about starving and everything, how did you guys do it? And he said, well, there are a lot of things, but part of it is we were competitive. You know, if this guy could make it 2 days, then I'd try to make it 2.5. And if I made it 2.5, another guy would try to make it 3. And I know that sounds weird, but that's just the
psychology.
The human psychology and psyche of fighter pilots, I guess, to be pretty competitive. So we had that mentality in there.
There's almost you almost turn the knob on them to, well, all you're doing is giving us a reason to challenge each other and show you what we can do.
Yeah, well, they were trying to destroy our sense of dignity and to destroy our confidence, because if they could do that, then we'd be put in their hands. So every day was really a battle to keep our dignity and to maintain our confidence and to maintain our integrity in the organization as part of the organization, because if they could isolate us and divide us, they might be able to conquer us. So we tried to stay connected even when we were isolated. We would risk our lives to get to somebody who was alone to say, man, hang in there. We're proud of you. We know you're here, and we're not going to leave without you.
Wow. So, McCain,
mm-hmm.
You want to...
Yeah, I could talk about John McCain, no problem at all. We were friends. He wrote the foreword to my 2012 book, Leading with Honor, Leadership Lessons from the Hanoi Hilton. I will say this. John McCain was probably the most wounded and injured, both wounded by the enemy and injured from his ejection right over Hanoi, of any POW who came home. So he was in really bad shape and probably wouldn't have would have died if they hadn't found out that his father was a four-star admiral in charge of the whole Pacific Command, everything, the war and everything. And so once they found that out, they recognized they had a good hostage. They didn't want him to die, so they did try to keep him alive with some minimum medical care, and they put a guy in his cell and then two guys to take care of him. Otherwise, he probably would have died. So in that regard, having a father as a four-star general was an advantage. But because of that, about 8 months later, when he was kind of recovered to a good bit, not totally recovered, he never totally recovered there, but they offered him, they released three guys in August of 1968, and they were going to release three more in the winter, spring of, well, they did release three more in February, and they're going to release McCain in the summer of 1968. And he refused to go because he knew it was a propaganda push. And with his father being an admiral and him being a POW, they're going to get a lot of mileage out of it. And they could say, well, you know, because of our lenient and humane policy, we're going to release him. Well, he knew people were being tortured, and he had been tortured. And so he said no. And because he refused to come home early, he was beaten and put in solitary for another year. So he was a very courageous guy, very tough, and all the POWs admire him for his resistance. So all the crap you see on the internet about McCain did this, McCain did that, he didn't do any of that. He resisted hard and was a tough guy in the POW camp, and we all admire him for that. So, you know, as a politician, you know, a lot of us agreed with a lot of he did, and we disagreed with some of his positions, but that's just normal. You know, it's a free country. We accepted that, but there were a lot we agreed with him on, and some things we disagreed, but he did serve well as a soldier in combat.
You know, I've had my thoughts. I've expressed my opinion, and I would publicly like to withdraw my opinion and apologize for some of the thoughts I had about McCain, and thoughts that we hear today are directed to hear by the fake news and by media that, you know, they weren't there, they didn't do it, and one of the biggest things that I can't stand, and I live right through every bit of this stuff in the 60s, and Walter Cronkite should have been drugged through the streets instead of anybody else. And the ridiculousness of giving a body bag count every night is just, in my mind now, is just totally deplorable. And, you know, I go back to my thing of, I wasn't there, I can't judge, I mean, I can't even come close to thinking about what you all went through, and we as a country have to remember this can't be like the textbooks today that give three pages to World War II. We have to keep telling there's nothing pretty about war. There's nothing romantic about it or anything else.
You know, the main thing that I got out of my experience as a prisoner of war in those years was the importance, the absolute essential importance of truth, because if you don't have truth, then you have somebody's lies, you have slants from the truth. And so when people shy from the truth, and when they shape the truth to give their message, this is what the communists did for us every day in their propaganda. They would take a little bit of truth and wrap a lot of stuff around it to make it seem and make you feel a certain way. Well, we saw into that very quickly. And I see that going on in this country, and it really bothers me when a person will take something that happened and spin it around to make it mean something totally different from what it really was. And, you know, when people do that, you know what the message, the real message is. They don't have enough truth and logic in their position to stand up and win people over to it, so they have to come up with a false message to make you feel a certain way, rather than show you the logic of why their logic, why their reasoning, and why their truth is actually going to work.
Lee, do you think that, and I hope it's did we get something out of your experience? Did the Air Force, did the Army, Navy, and the rest, have they, you know, we're talking what you've been, you were out in 73. 73, okay.
Yeah.
So, obviously, I know enough to know that you were debriefed and all this kind of stuff, but can you feel in your heart that my experience is helping those, not today, but in the future? Or the
yeah,
potential
I do.
Future?
I was just out at the SEER School, the Air Force SEER School in the state of Washington, and talked to them. And I think they're doing a really good job of helping people understand what they would encounter as a prisoner as best as they possibly could. We all have debriefed. We've had some of our guys who are actually on the faculty there, the staff there, training folks and helping design that. So I think so. You know, but it's always going to be different.
Yeah, I started to say if they're being trained, and this is the possibility if you were captured, but the Vietnamese, we'd never encountered anything like the Vietnamese, but then they're a hell of a lot different from Iranians or Middle Easterners or, you know, wherever. So, you know, you can't say, well, this is what they're going to do compared to over here, but there is a common ground, I guess. You're locked up, and that's a common ground of you could go stare crazy in a 4x8 cell.
I think the code of conduct is served us well. And they only changed one word to clarify about what you can give. It used to say, I will only give name, rank, service number. Now it says, I'm required to give. And they changed the word only, moved it around so that I am only required to give that. And I will try not to give anything that would harm my country or its allies and that sort of thing. So, and I think that because that's the way it worked, they could make you answer a question more than name, rank, service, number, date of birth, but you didn't have to give them the truth, and so we didn't. You know, I'm a very truthful person, but I turned out to be a really good liar when I had to be. So I lie with a straight face, and to look sad when I thought like that would be helpful, and to look happy when I thought like that would be helpful. If I could deceive them in a way that was effective to our mission and cause, then I certainly would, just like you would an enemy. You know, you have we'd drop out chaff to deceive the radars so they wouldn't lock onto the airplane. So we'd throw out a little chaff as we needed to.
This has been fascinating. Unfortunately, like with everyone we've had in, the hour goes very, very fast. And, Lee, I want to thank you. And will you come back?
I'll do it someday. When my schedule slows down a little bit, I'm an old man, but I don't feel like an old man most of the time, and I'm very blessed to be able to travel, to speak. I just finished a new book. I have clients. I'm doing leadership training for our university faculty and staff tomorrow.
Wow.
I'm doing leadership training for school superintendents from all over the state of Georgia in 2 weeks, and then I'm speaking at a university to a business school at the end of the month. So, in fact, the 28th of January is the day the Georgia Military Veterans Hall of Fame is having their event here in Atlanta. I just remembered for sure. It's the 29th of January, and I want to be there, and I'm going to try to be there, but I've got a couple other things going on. I got to try to work out so I can be there. But all that to say, I'm busy. I'm very blessed. I have a wonderful wife and family. I wasn't married when I was there. I got married a year after I got back. I've been married 45 years. And, you know, life is good. Life is never easy, but it's really good.
It's really good. Colonel, retired Leon Lee Ellis, thank you for coming in and being on the show. And we'll figure out a way to get you back.
I look forward to it. I will be back.
Okay.
Yes, clearly.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah.
You're listening to America's Web Radio, and you've been listening to the Georgia Military Veterans Hall of Fame Hour on America's Web Radio. Stay tuned. We've got another guest coming in very shortly. Thank you.
You're listening to America's Web Radio on the AmericasBroadcastNetwork.com. Thank you for listening.